the defendant will pay this much and then 3 years later pay this other amount, pay for a college education or some other kind of expense down the road. The advantages to it are several. One advantage is that the defendant doesn't have to come up with the cash right now. The defendant gets to pay over time, which we take advantage of when we borrow money to buy a house or get a graduate school education or the like. And defendants like that idea too. Secondly, it gives the plaintiff essentially a built-in investment. As we've talked about before, there's always risk when you put money in some sort of investment. If you try to find the most lucrative investment, you may take risks that wind up turning out badly. If you take the safest possible investment, you may not get a very good rate of return. So again, the plaintiff may benefit from having, in effect, an institution, let's say, you know, an insurance company or Avista Utilities or some other large institution may be willing to pay this money, in effect, through their own investment uses. So the third advantage is a tax advantage. As we talked about before, I think I mentioned it in passing, the award of damages or the settlement of a claim for damages for personal injury, that's not a taxable receipt. And even though the award may include compensation for economic harm, and the settlement would likely include the same thing, the IRS finally decided to simply, or Congress decided to simply remove the taxation from a personal injury award. There is still taxation for things like punitive damages or certain kinds of tort damages, but not for personal injury. Now, when you work out a structured settlement, you say, for example, the defendant will pay in 10 years or 20 years. When that payment is made, it is after tax dollars. You don't pay interest on that, or it's not a taxable event. Whereas if you give me the lump sum today and I go out and invest it and I earn dividends or interest on that money, that income, interest or dividend income, is taxable. So for the same amount of money, having the defendant invest it and then pay me 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I essentially get that money tax-free, whereas if I do the investing myself, I pay the taxes. Now, despite these advantages, some plaintiffs may still prefer to get the money in their hot little hands today rather than be forced to wait to get it. They may have needs for that money now. In fact, if you watch late night TV, occasionally you'll see an ad for somebody saying, "Do you have money coming through? You know, we'll so and so will give you cash today for that." So people sometimes want to convert a long-term stream of income into a present cash value. But as I say, many people will find this combination of features quite attractive and will do it. Obviously, you have to worry about the defendant's ability. Suppose you make this deal with Avista Utilities and Avista Utilities goes under, or you make it with an insurance company and the insurance company has, all their clients are in Los Angeles and their houses burned down and the insurance company goes broke. So you may want to have a guarantee of some kind, a secondary payor, who backs up the obligation of your primary obligor, like Avista Utilities, and then reinsured, in effect, by some annuity company or insurance company of the like, as a protection against the potential for your investment to go bad. But again, compared to taking my money and investing it in some investment vehicle, the idea of having the defendant do that for me can be quite attractive. So again, if you ever hear this idea of a structured settlement, you'll understand why people like that idea and why it's often the way that cases get settled. It isn't the investment takes place behind the scenes. That is, what the plaintiff and the defendant agree to. You know, let's say, for example, I've got a case where the number we're talking about is $100,000. The plaintiff's willing to take $100,000. The defendant's willing to pay $100,000. One or the other may say, well, how about a structure here? And the other party says, yeah, let's look at that. And then you essentially go buy an annuity or, you know, talk to a financial planner who says, well, for $100,000, here's the package I could get you. $10,000 a year for the next 5 years, then, you know, a lump sum payment, blah, 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 blah. So I can work out these numbers, and again, using the discounted present value of this or the enhanced future value, this is what I can get you, and the defendant is essentially, but the defendant then becomes the person taking their chances. Avista Utilities, for example, figures that if they have the use of this money, they can, in effect, get 4% rate of return because that's less money they have to go out and borrow or what have you. So they're the ones doing the investment, and they stand to gain or lose if, for example, inflation, you know, we're agreeing to real dollars here, so if inflation is high or low, the plaintiff or the defendant will get the benefit or take the lumps on that reality. Yes. Right. Again, the same reversal as a mortgage. You know, I can go out and buy a $100,000 house today. When I pay back the mortgage money, it's going to be $300,000, and vice versa. So again, if for example, your clients, we had a case I'll talk about later in another area involving, you know, two small children who lost their parents in a sailing accident. For them, a settlement made a lot of sense, which postponed the receipt of money until they became adults, paid for their college education, and then provided them with, you know, money as in essence to start their adult life, postponed until after they were mature enough to know what to do with it, and that made a lot more sense than to have something that put the money in the hands of a guardian or someone else who had to worry about it and the like. Yeah. If you haven't arranged for a guarantee, and again, for that very possibility, if I'm dealing with Avista Utilities, as much confidence as I may have that Avista Utilities is going to be around in 5 years or 10 years, I may say, will you provide a secondary guarantee so that Travelers Insurance or someone else is like a co-signer of this loan, in effect, so that if something unusual happens and Avista goes broke, I won't be stuck with a worthless obligation. Ms. Johnson? In a normal kind of case, that's the one part of the structure that is taken care of up front. So the lawyer typically doesn't want a structured settlement. The lawyer could agree to one, but it typically doesn't benefit the lawyer because to the lawyer it's not a personal injury award, it's ordinary income, so the tax benefits disappear, and lawyers tend to be desperate for money now rather than later. Ordinarily, the agreement will be, since from the defendant's standpoint, it's all the same, the defendant will pay that contingency fee up front. The one complication is in those areas where, for example, I believe the rule under the Federal Tort Claims Act is that plaintiff's lawyers can receive no more than 25% contingency fee of any award made to a child, and it can it is and that has been interpreted to mean if the child's receipt of the money is postponed, the lawyer's receipt of the money is postponed as well. So it's actually one of the things we'll talk later on in Chapter 3 about the phenomenon of attorney's fees and how the need to collect an attorney's fee affects the dynamics of tort litigation. And there is a lot of criticism of the contingency fee system. There are also, as you might imagine, many enthusiastic advocates for the contingency fee system, but it does create some ethical tension. The most significant amount of ethical tension is where the client's interest and the lawyer's interest diverge with respect to the settlement of a case. Sometimes the plaintiff will be inclined, the lawyer tends to be in a position where it's profitable to take chances. If I have four cases, I can roll the dice on all four of them, figuring that the odds are with me that one or more of them is going to pay off. And so I will maximize my recovery in the basket of those four cases. And the fact that my recovery may range between $50,000 and $200,000 for this basket of four cases, I'm okay with that. Some will pay nothing, some will pay $150,000. For the client who doesn't have a basket of cases, has only one case, they tend to be more risk averse. It isn't always true. Sometimes plaintiffs are irrationally, one would think from a purely financial standpoint, plaintiffs are irrationally desirous of a jury verdict. The plaintiff will tell the lawyer when a reasonable, decent settlement offer is made and the lawyer's inclined to think, that's a pretty good settlement offer. I really don't think you're likely to improve on this at trial. And the client will say, I'd rather hear it from the jury. I know there's a risk I will lose this case. If the jury wants to look me in the eye and say, it wasn't his fault, fine, I'll take it from the jury, but I'm not going to walk away with less than what I deserve. On the other hand, the more common thing is that clients are risk averse. They're not willing to say, gee, there's a pretty good chance we can get $250,000 here. There's a chance we'll get nothing. But there's a pretty good likelihood you're going to get $180,000 net out of this case. And the lawyer says, let's go for it. And the client says, no, if there's a chance I'm going to get nothing out of this and I can't even afford a wheelchair for my kid, I'd rather take that $75,000 settlement offer that's the last offer the defendant made. And I know the lawyer's really unhappy about that. The lawyer wants to roll the dice, is willing to take that chance of getting nothing because the chances are pretty good the jury verdict's going to be in the range of $250,000. But you can take that chance. You've got a basket of cases. I got this one case. I can't take that risk. So it tends to be that clients are more risk averse and the lawyer is more risk, at least risk neutral, if not something of a riverboat gambler who kind of likes the thrill of seeing what happens. You can have the situation flipped around where the plaintiff's lawyer is desperate to meet payroll this month and needs this case to settle because I've got this great one waiting in the wings here. If I can keep working on that, but I can't keep working on that as long as I got no money coming in the door. And this case over here might be worth a little more if we took it to trial. On a different day, I might hold out, but we got to get that case settled. That's what the lawyer's voice is saying inside the lawyer's head. And that creates an ethical dilemma. Do I want to settle this case because it's beneficial to the client, or do I want to settle this case because they really want to meet payroll this month? And every plaintiff's lawyer is in that dilemma. It's one of the great things. I don't know if Jerry still has you read, or anybody else has you read, a civil action. If you read a civil action, it's a great story. It's a true story. But it's a great illustration of the way in which a really very good lawyer, Jan Schlickman, is a very good lawyer. He's, I don't know, he's returned to life. He's, you know, he was out of it for a while. He quit his practice. And in any event, he was a very good lawyer, and he got in big trouble because he needed to meet payroll. You know, the book opens up with his having his Porsche towed away. You know, it's that happens. And not because he sat down one day and said, I'm gonna make some ethical compromises, but because stuff happens. And he miscalculated and he got tied up and unexpected things happened to him. It did not go according to his plan. But again, the pressures on the lawyer who's operating on a contingency fee to compromise what abstractly would be good for the client so that the lawyer can get his or her business done, that's a very difficult, and it's very hard for the lawyer to operate independently, to really ask the question, leaving aside the fact that if I don't meet payroll this month, my employees are going to quit and the bank's going to foreclose and I'm going to be in deep trouble, not to mention my Porsche is going to get towed away. Leaving aside that, what are the real merits of this case? We have very high ethical standards for avoiding lawyers having a conflict of interest. I can't represent the husband and the wife in a dissolution action, no matter the fact that they're both good friends of mine and I want to do what's right for this family, and I wouldn't, you know, I'm a really high, we just, where you have two, you, as the gospel says, you can't serve two masters. So we are very careful about that, but in every contingency fee case, the plaintiff's lawyer serves two masters. I'm meeting my own payroll, and I'm trying to figure out what's right for this client. Defense lawyers are under the same ethical dilemma often, because their nominal client is an insured of an insurance company who pays the bills. And nominally, I represent this insured and the interests of this insured, but my bills are being paid by an institution that's trying to maximize their return and minimize how much they pay on any individual case. So there are strong ethical tensions on both sides of the average tort case. And again, we really don't have an answer to that. You could get rid of the contingency fee system. I'm not sure that would, in the long run, benefit plaintiffs. I don't know what you could do on the other side to eliminate the problem with insurance companies and the competing loyalties of the defense lawyer. In many cases, you simply trust the ethics of the individual lawyer to do what's right, even though doing what's right may require some sacrifice. Anyway, I can't even remember what your question was and where I went with that. It started out with a contingency fee. How does the structure work with the contingency fee? Other questions here. Well, I mean, that as we'll see when we get to the end of this first section and we talk about attorney's fees, the court awards damages, which are always understated. If they're accurate in terms of assessing the plaintiff's damage, the plaintiff has to forego a third of that to pay the lawyer who got the award. And you could argue, and many people do argue, that this creates an inherent injustice in the system. It either results in juries and the system overcompensating plaintiffs so that after you subtract the one-third, the plaintiff truly gets compensated. In which case, defendants have a right to complain that they're overcompensating here. Or it creates a system in which the plaintiffs routinely get undercompensated, and it's the lawyers. Again, Paul Levera, who has been very generous to this law school, so I speak ill of him. I'm not really speaking ill of him, please. There's a case I read a couple of years ago where he was the plaintiff's lawyer. He represented a baby who was in the hospital, and somebody negligently didn't pay attention to this kid when he had some formula in his mouth. He choked on the formula and got brain damage. $10 million judgment. The way most plaintiff's lawyers work is, and Paul Levera is no exception, a third, sometimes 40% if the case goes to trial, goes to the lawyer. So the jury's award is $10 million. Paul Levera gets $4 million. The baby with a lifetime of brain damage gets $6 million. What do you think about that? One is getting compensated for a lifetime of brain damage. The other is getting compensated for his professional skill. And very skilled he is. But is there anything wrong with that picture? Should there be more compensation so that Paul Levera can subtract his 40% and we get $10 million? I mean, again, what's going on in that case? But I don't want to get too far ahead. Well, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Maybe we should postpone this until we get to that point. But it's a very real question about the tort system. And again, it's the kind of thing, I don't want to give you the impression I spend all my time at cocktail parties. But to the extent that the question in the cocktail party from the average observer of the tort system is to look at the really fabulously wealthy plaintiff's lawyers and say there's something rotten about this system. And answering that question, either no, it's not a rotten system. In fact, we should be very proud that in the United States, ordinary people can get high-priced lawyers and get justice. If you lived in Japan or in Germany or in wherever that has a different kind of legal system, they don't have a flourishing plaintiff's personal injury bar. And if you get run over by a truck, it's a lot less likely you're going to get justice in those places. That's the argument for it. Again, the argument I tend to hear, I have a brother who's a physician, and so I tend to get a good earful from him when I see him about, you know, not feeling as though our society treats doctors as well as it treats lawyers. That since laws tend to be made by lawyers, they tend to favor the legal profession, and doctors have steadily been sold down the river. That's his perspective. So I have that voice very clearly in my right ear, as I have the voice very clearly in my left ear of the trial lawyers defending the merits of the system. So again, I think it's very important that we get to that question, but maybe we should do that in due course. Let's. In the last 20 minutes, let's talk about non-economic damages. Let's first quickly look at the first of our railroad cases here, Morris versus Auburn. it's not really, you don't get the facts here, but you get the court's decision on a question posed. The question posed is, should we consider pain and suffering damages part of a compensatory award, or should pain and suffering damages be placed on the side of the ledger that deals with some sort of exemplary or punitive damages that are awarded for malice or intentional conduct, but aren't ordinarily awarded for merely negligent injury? The court's answer to that question? Yeah, if we're going to compensate people for personal injury, for accidental, negligently inflicted injury, we can't limit it simply to the economic harm. According to this case, at least, we should consider the pain and suffering damages to be part and parcel of compensation. If you break my arm through your negligence, I can have the court make you pay for my economic loss, for the medical treatment, for any wage loss that I've suffered. Some injuries will have fairly substantial economic loss. Some will have relatively modest economic loss, but may inflict substantial pain and suffering. This is a typical soft tissue injury case. I get whiplash or some other kind of injury where it doesn't break any bones or what have you, but I'm physically injured. I may still be able to show up at work, but I'm miserable. I'm in pain. I can't do the things that give me pleasure in life. I can't concentrate, or I can't, you know, read. I can't go bowling. I can't do other things that I like to do. Do I deserve to be compensated for the loss of enjoyment of those things, or the fact that I can only do them with considerable pain and suffering? The answer of this court, at least, is you should be compensated for that. And there really isn't a whole lot of dispute over that proposition. Now, one of the things that happens in tort reform, as we'll see later on, is that we begin to distinguish economic and pain and suffering loss for purposes of saying what things are awardable in particular kinds of cases. Even in wrongful death cases, we may separate the economic loss from the non-economic loss and say one is compensable, the other is not. But at least our starting proposition is that true compensation includes both economic and non-economic loss. And as I say, for that proposition, there is relatively strong support. We may, for other reasons, begin to chip away at it, but stated in the abstract, not too many people disagree. But no sooner do we have that principle than we begin to ask whether we're really sure we believe that, as reflected by Spade versus Lynn. Can somebody tell me about, I think I made reference before to the lady on the train here and the injury that she suffers and what the court does with her? Mr. Fowler. Yes. These drunk guys are tussling with each other somehow, kind of, one of them loses his balance and falls on her. Okay? Now what? First of all, what injury does she suffer? Okay. Yeah. She's, I mean, apparently she's a woman of a great sensitivity. This experience just causes her to really react quite dramatically to it, and she suffers intense emotional anxiety or disgust or fright or some combination of that. Okay? So she sues to recover for these damages, and what happens to her at the trial court? Actually, I'm not sure they were so instructed. What was their ultimate verdict? Okay. So the jury makes an award to her of damages, and the defendant appeals. And what's the defendant's argument on appeal? Right. The defendant says our rule is no physical injury. No mere emotional damages. And again, everybody is in agreement that if there is a physical injury, if the button on one of these guys' coats, scrapes her across the cheek and draws some blood, or she's got a bruise from this injury, she has a physical injury, then the rest of her emotional injury is recoverable. But in the absence of a physical injury, she can't recover. What's the court's answer to that proposition from the defendant? Okay, why does it make sense? But let me test that for a moment to say, suppose, again, the button on the guy's coat cuts her across the cheek, draws a little bit of blood, but it's something that by the time her deposition is taken 6 weeks later, it's healed up again. No scar, no nothing. But she claims all of these accompanying emotional damages. She has recurrent nightmares. You know, she can't even get on the subway anymore. She's got to walk. She's got to have a friend. And the defendant's argument is, everybody's different. Why should we pay for the injuries of this woman? Because a normal person wouldn't have that kind of reaction. What would the court answer to that claim? But we have a rule for those kinds of cases. Remember what our rule is for a case in which she's got this relatively modest intrusion, but she has these huge damages because of her sensitivity. What's our rule for those cases? There's a term for that. The thin skull plaintiff rule. In for a penny, eggshell plaintiff. In for a penny, in for a pound. If you acknowledge, hey, I'm liable for this, but a normal person wouldn't have that kind of reaction, tough luck. You take your victim as you find him. So why is it any different when she suffers mere emotional harm? Is it because the emotional harm isn't real? Is it because we're afraid that juries wouldn't be able to tell the difference between somebody who's telling you the truth and somebody who's just faking it? Mr. Boyer? What do you mean it's impossible to administer them? Why don't we simply give all these cases to the jury and let them You know, like Deacon Jones going through the backfield. You know, you go through them until you find the one with the ball. Oh, you mean the train people would be in trouble because they wouldn't know how to run a train if they could be held liable for all the emotional injuries that are caused by drunk people and other people careening around and causing emotional harm. We go too fast around a corner. We stop suddenly. No physical injury, but people are freaked out. And now suddenly we're in the compensation business for all those emotional injuries. Is that the problem? Okay, in some ways, you're both right here. There are a variety of different considerations that go into it, but there is a primary focus, I think, on the limits of the tort system. That is, when you stop to think about it, suppose we didn't have this rule, and we said, even though you don't suffer physical injury, you can recover for emotional harm caused by people's negligence. You can probably think of three instances yesterday when somebody's negligence caused you emotional harm. Somebody said that they would bring, you know, your school books for you, and then they forgot about it. Or somebody said their dry cleaning was going to be ready. Or somebody said, you know, whatever it is. We all the time, alas, human frail creatures that we are, do things, negligent things, and we inflict emotional harm on other people. Are we going to turn the tort system into a compensatory system for awarding damages for emotional harm caused by people's negligence? I don't think so. Is this an arbitrary rule? Absolutely. But it provides some kind of a filtering mechanism to say those kinds of emotional harms that are caused by or accompany physical injury count in a way that the other kinds of damages don't. So let's suppose, for example, you know, I loaned somebody a car so that, you know, they needed to run some errand, but I made it really clear you need to bring the car back because I've got an interview with this law firm this afternoon. And then they space it out or, you know, what, they get caught in traffic or whatever it is. They don't make it in time and I miss my interview. I'm really going to be ticked off. But that harm, because it doesn't have a physical injury connected with it, doesn't count for purposes of the tort system. Only those things which either have a physical injury as their source, you got to draw blood, break a bone, you know, cause a bruise, some kind of physical injury, or it has to at least produce a physical injury. So I may frighten somebody so badly they have a heart attack. That counts, but not something where it's merely emotional harm without any physical injury. Now, obviously we have a difficulty figuring out what's a physical injury. Does it really literally have to draw blood? What's a bruise? You know, if I can see the pattern of the button on my cheek, you know, somebody's got their little digital camera phone and they snap a little picture and I can see this place where the button on the guy's coat made an impression on my cheek. Is that a physical injury, or does it actually have to leave a bruise? Scratch? Or does it actually have to draw? You know, we have some line drawing problems here, but at least we have some kind of a criterion. But again, the proposition that we start with serves this very important filtering process to separate those claims where it is worth the tort system compensating, as distinguished from those cases where we say, gee, I'm terribly sorry that because we got your dry cleaning order mixed up, you don't have that suit you were planning to wear for the wedding or for the interview or what have you, but hey, it'll be ready tomorrow, or we accidentally gave that to somebody else and we've got this other, it's a Navy suit here, it's maybe not the right size, but that kind of stuff, again, simply goes uncompensated. Yeah. No, the filtering process that we're talking about is where the judge acts as the gatekeeper. If it doesn't meet this physical injury criterion, the judge throws it out. Yes, right. And obviously there are cases where that's a judgment call. Suppose, for example, as a result of the severe emotional shock, I have a dramatic change in my blood pressure, and suppose I'm hypertensive and I've got, this huge spike in my blood pressure, and that causes me to need other kinds of medication or what have you. Or I'm diabetic and I have these changes in my insulin level or what have you, and it really throws me for a loop. Is that a physical injury? We don't know exactly. Yeah. Again, our starting rule is if you haven't suffered a physical injury, you don't have a claim in the tort system for merely negligently inflicted harm. If, by contrast, someone does this intentionally or recklessly, we have a different standard of culpability, but for ordinary negligence, that's not enough. Now, no sooner do we have that kind of a rule, then we're going to see pressure to make exceptions to it. We'll see the exception to it in the Johnson case, but before we get to Johnson, we should probably spend some time here on, we'll at least get started with this Carter case. I don't want to leave you entirely with this, because what we have is except. Here's our general rule, but now we're going to begin to look for potential exceptions to it. Temple or the Carter case is actually one that doesn't constitute necessarily an exception to this rule. The plaintiff is arguing more along the lines of an emotional injury that accompanies a physical injury. We're sort of confused about whether it's really a physical injury yet at all. So can somebody tell us about Carter? Ms. Johnson. Okay, so what's the plaintiff's claim here? Okay, and so what kind of mental anguish? Why does, apparently this guy recovers their normal breathing function, why do they have any... Yeah, you just put me at risk, higher risk of getting some kind of asbestos-related cancer. Can we quantify that? Not very easily, but the fact is you gave me an exposure to this through your negligence that has now put me at higher risk of a disease down the road. Is that compensable? The plaintiffs say... Why is it compensable? First of all, how does it fit with our rule here? Don't we have a rule that says in the absence of physical injury, you can't recover for mere emotional injury? How would you, if you were the plaintiff's advocate here, fit this case within that rule? Yeah, right. You want a physical injury? I got a physical injury. I got these little corkscrew asbestos fibers lurking in my lungs and in the lining of my lungs. And for all I know, those things are going to spring on me, so to speak, later on and manifest themselves in the form of a deadly cancer. I've been injured. I'll happily give you these fibers. I'd like them out of my lungs. I can't get them out. They're stuck there. The court doesn't necessarily disagree with the proposition that this might be a physical injury, but the court says it has a different reason. What's the court's conclusion? Let's just jump to the bottom line here. Let's start with the trial court and then do the court of appeals. Yes. We actually have three courts here. We have the trial court, we have the intermediate court, and then we have this court. Yeah. So, the intermediate court disagrees and tries to reinstate these claims. So the initial decision of the trial court is to dismiss the plaintiff's claims. The intermediate court says, on second thought, let's give these guys their day in court. But the Supreme Court, okay, and what's the reasoning of the Supreme Court? Maybe we'll have to pick this up tomorrow to figure out what the reasoning of the court is. Why won't they give these guys a recovery despite the fact that they clearly suffered an injury, a physical injury of some kind, and they have reasonable apprehension about their long-term risk of some kind of cancer? But why the court says no to them, we'll pick up tomorrow.